Now stay tuned for the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And thanks to everyone for being with us again today, Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. We're going to talk about current public policy on drugs. A lot of this came into my mind after Election Day of 2020. There were a lot of initiatives that were changed towards the side of reformers. So we asked Professor Richard Bonney from the University of Virginia to step in. He's a professor of law and medicine, also professor of public policy and psychiatry and neurobehavioral science. He's a director of the Institute of Law, Psychiatry, and Public Policy at the university. His first book, The Marijuana Conviction, A History of Marijuana Prohibition in the United States, considered a drug policy classic. Chaired a commission on mental health law reform at the request of the Chief Justice of Virginia in 2006 to 2011. And an expert on the advisory panel on mental health reform for the Virginia General Assembly. He was elected to the National Academy of Medicine in 1991, and he received the University of Virginia's highest honor, the Thomas Jefferson Award, in 2007. Professor Bonney, thank you so much for taking the time to be here with us.
Pleasure to be with you.
Let's just jump to what got me interested in today's topic. If you go back to Election Day of 2020, it was a major rejection on the war on drugs. Every state with ballot measure asking Americans to reconsider the drug war, voters sided with reformers. Arizona, Montana, New Jersey, and South Dakota voters legalized marijuana for recreational purposes. Mississippi and South Dakota, separate from the legalization measure, voters legalized medical use of marijuana. Oregon voters decriminalized all drugs, including cocaine and heroin. Also in Oregon, voters legalized the use of psilocybin, psychedelic drug found in magic mushrooms, for supervised therapeutic uses. Marijuana is now fully illegal in only 11 of the 50 states, I believe. It's just fascinating to me where we stand now versus where we were 25 to 35 years ago. And so I reach out to you to help us, to take us through the history and help us understand what happened in 2020. So can you start by giving us some sort of historical perspective?
Well, this is a topic, as your introduction probably suggested to your listeners, that's of great interest to me. And I've been involved as an observer, even in writing some of the history, but also as a participant at various points. I think people should know that in advance. I'll probably step back and have a little distance in what I say to you. So I think it's a great topic, and I can certainly understand your reaction to what happened at the polls this year. Before I take, the invitation to reflect, on the history and what it means, I want to make one sort of definitional point here, or at least raise a question and talk about it a little bit so we know that we're talking about the same thing. So when you were referring to marijuana and the policies that states have been adopting with regard to marijuana for the last decade or so, and the recent votes, you referred to the term decriminalized. And I think we just ought to spend a couple of minutes talking about that, because I think when I go over the history, my interpretation is going to emphasize this. So when the terms often used and that you were using about marijuana are legalization and decriminalization. And that may not be entirely obvious to people what the difference is. So decriminalization has generally been understood to refer to withdrawal of criminal penalties from people who choose to use drugs, whatever it is that's being decriminalized. So the drug, the distribution of the drug, and perhaps if it grows, cultivation of the drug remains illegal, generally speaking. Commercial activity, it's probably the best way to put it in there. But people who obtain the drug and use it, notwithstanding whatever effort society is making to not make it easy for them, are not punished. Legalization refers to making the distribution, cultivation, production, distribution legal, and typically regulating it in some way. And so the alcohol model, the tobacco, alcohol sort of obviously fall in that category. And so over the course of the debate about marijuana policy, which got me into this business back in the late 1960s, has typically drawn a pretty clear distinction between those two policy options. So when this election occurred, the important issues with regard to marijuana policy that were on the ballot, generally speaking, were about legalization and whether the state for medical uses alone or for medical uses and non-recreational or non-medical uses should set up a system by which people could lawfully obtain the drug. And as you said, I mean, I think it's now something, I haven't got the numbers exactly in my head right now, I think it's something like 36 states have legalized medical access to marijuana. And I think now the number is something like 16 that have done so with regard to recreational use or non-medical use. So that's kind of where we are. And the let me now sort of, that's just to keep that in mind, because part of the story I want to tell is that I think there are two things going on now in terms of changes in public policy that ought not to be regarded as one thing. I think there are two things, trends that are going on that link with regard to the drug war, so-called, and that's another question about kind of what that means too. But they're not the same story. So in order to sort of draw that distinction, maybe I will draw that out as we talk later. I mean, I'll go back and start the story, but I think what I'm going to try to do is interpret a couple of the things that are going on. I think are clearly, as you said, a rejection of the drug war, which maybe I will say what I intend to say, that is really a very much overlaps general concerns about criminal justice reform that are even post-election. We see how important, you know, that is. The drug war, again, and I'm going to define what I mean by that, that we are now talking about, basically dates this particular version of the drug war, dates from a significant increase in cocaine use in the 1980s, and highly repressive punitive policies that were instituted at that time. It was tied up with a lot of gun violence, but that was, as people use the drug war term for different things, but that was a very intensive and repressive policy that was initiated, you know, during that period of time. And I think often, you know, and we are still in some respects experiencing some of the consequences of that, because there was this tremendous turn to repressive punishments. And then you had, you know, clearly the racially disparate impact of those penalties. It also was concordant with a larger trend in imposing more punishment for all crime, repealing parole, increasing the levels of penalties, greater minimum sentences. The drug penalties were part of that. And they did kind of occur about the same time, but it was part of a larger, truly mistaken, repressive turn in American criminal justice policy. And again, that relates in substantial increase in incarceration, with all, as we know now, all the disparities that came along with that. And that policy stayed in effect for a long time before finally the pendulum began to swing against it. And so the drug war part of it, which, as I said, you know, clearly there was an element of that because of the cocaine epidemic, was really, I think, part of that larger trend. So part of what I want to try to persuade you is that what we're seeing now is at least a part of a reaction, a continuing part of criminal justice reform to adopt more mitigated penalties, to try to divert people to treatment, you know, for conditions that could benefit from treatment, introduce greater discretion into the system, and so on. And clearly, with regard to addiction, there's been a very, very significant turn away from these repressive policies toward a, what I call a more public health and more therapeutic approach to addiction.
Now, well, let me ask you a question real quick. Yeah. So you mentioned earlier, you made a brief mention of alcohol. I'm curious why marijuana specifically, as you defined decriminalization versus legalization,
right,
and tossed alcohol in there for a moment, why has marijuana in many states only taken one step towards the level of alcohol? What is this purpose in adding this midway point here?
What do you mean by the midway point? Decriminalization?
Well, instead of saying, yes, you can have it, such as with alcohol, or no, you can't, such as with making it illegal, what is the purpose of saying it's decriminalized and you can have it, but we'll look the other way?
Yes. All right. Well, I want to answer that question because it goes back to the commission for which I was the associate director. And so if we could just bracket what I was saying about criminal justice policy generally, the other story I believe that is here is a marijuana specific story. And it's not quite the same thing as the story that I just told. Again, just so that your listeners are understanding, one of the couple of the changes that occurred that you mentioned, involved decriminalization of possession of all drugs, right, supposedly, and not just marijuana. And I think that's a different story in my mind in terms of what's actually going on.
Right. Oregon did that.
Yes. And I want to come back to that because I think that to my mind, there's Portugal is part of this discussion as well. And I think what they have done is adopt a more public health oriented policy toward the use of all illicit drugs. They haven't tried to legalize the drugs, but they want to correct for the excesses of a highly punitive and very, very costly a drug war type of policy. So I think that's part of a discussion, and let's just bracket that completely now and go to what you just asked me, which is what I think is the marijuana story here, which is not quite the same thing. So let's begin with the increase in marijuana use. Marijuana use has been illegal in this country basically since the beginnings of the 20th century, late 19th, early 20th century. The prohibition was adopted in a bunch of states. It was all related to basically Mexican immigration, and the drug was, you know, declared illegal in the various states. And then eventually Congress did it in the so-called Marijuana Tax Act in 1937. And then some more states did it, and then it was basically illegal everywhere. Then it got tied up in that respect also with other illegal drugs. And at that point, and whenever the federal government increased penalties, they also increased them for marijuana. So very little distinction was basically drawn at that point. By the end of the 1960s, essentially distribution, possession, cultivation, and all these offenses with regard to marijuana and other drugs was many places a felony. Minimum mandatory penalties had been imposed because there was an outbreak of heroin use in New York in the 1950s, which then drove a little mini drug war in terms of increasing the penalties. Then in the 1960s, you had basically the anti-war movement, you had general dissent, you had an increase in marijuana use as part of a culture war of the time, and that came into clash with these highly punitive penalties that had emerged with regard to marijuana. And that's what led the Congress in 1970 to establish the National Commission on Marijuana and Drug Abuse to take a look at drug policy and decide what should be done, since there was, you know, clearly this huge clash, you know, that was going on, a big sort of marijuana legalization, you know, activity. But in some respects, it was symbolic. It was tied up with the Vietnam War and dissent and so on. All right, so this is our commission then was established, and I was fortunate enough to be the associate director of the commission. To make a very long story short about that, the way the commission framed the problem is that, or the policy options, that there is basically three choices. You know, one was to basically retain the current policy of prohibition, you know, have penalties maybe that were more commensurate with the seriousness of the offense. Nobody on the commission favored these highly punitive penalties, but basically keep prohibition intact. On the other extreme, the alternative was to legalize, to adopt the so-called alcohol model, which is what the reformers were basically arguing for. And say the marijuana is not as harmful as heroin and cocaine and so on. It's probably less harmful than alcohol. Why don't we, you know, legalize and adopt the alcohol model? So that's one possibility. The commission said there's also another possibility, which is to decriminalize possession. You know, this society might have every reason that they want to discourage use of the drug. There's a lot that we don't know about marijuana, the effects of marijuana, and this was true at the time. Also, we said that even if we wanted to legalize, and we did say quite clearly, marijuana, however, whatever its harms are, is less harmful than alcohol use, however you ultimately sort of, you know, once we do the research and we try to make informed policy, if you were to go to a regulatory model, the alcohol model is a failure. And that if you're going to actually legalize the drug and allow it to be, you know, available, obviously not to kids, for whatever use people wanted to make of it, we needed to learn more about how you do that and protect the public health. And meanwhile, there was also tobacco. And I think we had pretty good reasons for saying that. Even if you go decriminalize first and then see what happens, and then if you have to adopt a regulatory model, learn how to do it correctly. So that was what was said at the time. And the history, I think, in terms of what has happened, the commission said that in 1972, in the 5 years immediately thereafter, 12 states decriminalized. It was a mainstream proposal. All editorial support from all places on the political spectrum, as well as all sorts of organizations, National Education Association, National Public Health Association. It was kind of a mainstream proposal, and it was being implemented in all the states. What happened was that toward the end of the 70s, for reasons that we can talk about, the pendulum began to swing backward, and the overall politics essentially yielded to the policies that are identified with Nancy Reagan, just say no and zero tolerance for any illegal drug.
Well, hang on there and let's take a break and come back and talk more about where we are in the 80s.
Right.
Okay. Professor Richard Bonney here, as we talk about public policy of drugs, where we were in the 70s, moving to the 80s with the war on drugs, and what happened on election day with all the initiatives to legalize and decriminalize drugs throughout the U.S. Be right back. Thanks for being here with us. Sunday morning wake-up call. I'm Rick Moore. Professor Richard Bonney here with us. He's a professor of law at University of Virginia, along with many other fields. We are talking about public policy of drugs in the U.S. and how things have changed throughout the last half century. Professor, you were carrying us into the 80s with Nancy Reagan taking her topic as first lady and really leading the way into public policy.
Yes. So, again, I'm giving some nuance to this history, but I lived through it. So I really actually think I'm a pretty objective observer, I think, during this period of time. And I was right on the firing line. So even though the pendulum was swinging toward decriminalization of marijuana, the states were doing it. And then what happened in part, this is partly what my characterization of this, is that the commission, one of the important things the commission did was to begin to conduct polls, surveys, national surveys of use for kids and for adults that had never been done before we did the first of the nation. The first one in 1970 and then another one in 1971. So we had some sense of what the overall prevalence was. And fortunately, we recommended, again, a public health approach that the government, you know, should the National Institute on what became the National Institute on Drug Abuse, should conduct annual polls of this nature. And I think everybody recognizes every year you see the numbers about where things stand with regard to drug use, has it gone up or down, and so on. So they put those polls in place, and it did show, in a way that's not surprising, that marijuana use increased during this period in the 1970s, and that it increased among teenagers. And that is worrisome. That was worrisome, and so on. They attributed it to the movement toward decriminalization because it suggested a more tolerant, you know, effect and, you know, a policy and so on. So those polls played into this, that it was because of decriminalization that these numbers were going up. And I think it wasn't about decriminalization, frankly. It was because it happened in state. It went up in states that hadn't decriminalized as well as some states that did. It was really the changing attitudes that already in the nation as a whole that accounted for this. But nonetheless, that was the argument. And so the effort to separate marijuana from other drugs that had been an important part of what we had said, receded. And instead, some states even began to repeal the decriminalization that they'd already adopted. And certainly no more states did it. The last one that did it during that period was in 1977. And then what happened was the crack epidemic kind of emerged in the early 70s after this had already happened. And that, as I suggested earlier, just reinforced this highly repressive, approach during the Reagan administration, then it eventually continued in George H.W. Bush's administration. So then we were in a new place with regard to drug policy because it was really a reversion back, you know, to the repressive policies that had preceded it. And it was a true, as I mentioned earlier, you know, a true drug war. And marijuana policy, you know, penalties just went back up again. So it was just such a change. I mean, what I had envisioned that there would be a period of decriminalization, we would learn something about the effects of marijuana, we would monitor what the effects were, and we might be able to learn something about how to do a better job of regulating alcohol. And there was actually, some initiatives made in that direction, actually, by the national government and some state governments, you know, during this period of time. There was also concern about drunk driving and so on. So a more public health oriented approach was, in the air, but it had this very, very repressive feature with regard to drug policy. So now we're in the 80s, right? And then, as I told you before, the drug policy part of this got submerged into this much broader, highly punitive criminal justice policy with the, what essentially everybody admits now was over-incarceration and a tremendous price that we're paying as a society even now for that with its amazing kind of racial disparities that were associated with it. Also was reflected in the cocaine epidemic, you know, as well. So things were basically stuck there. Throughout the rest of the of the 20th century, toward the end of the 20th century and into the 21st. Now, let me stop there and see what I'm going to do now is say the pendulum began to swing again back toward a more lenient drug policy. But before I jump into that, I want to make sure that we're kind of, you know, you're on the train here.
Well, I'm just curious. We talk about the punishment that was going on during the war on drugs. Who has the loudest voice? Is this the public who's saying, I want something done? Is this the politicians who were saying this is the moral thing that should be done? I mean, who's shouting?
Well, I think it's a great question. And again, I'm just going to give you my read of this because I lived through it. And as a citizen, you know, just as many of our listeners did. There was virtually the way I see it during that period of time when the pendulum swung as far, if I can call it, to the right as it did with regard to both criminal justice policy and drug policy. There was precious little dissent. It was political suicide for anyone to raise concerns about it. And we can hear that now, even in the election we were just in with Joe Biden. That people basically, whatever was going on in the culture then and the fear about crime and youth crime, youth penalties went up. Forget drugs. Penalties for kids penalties for delinquent behavior and then for more serious behavior that typically was still something that we would traditionally intervene in the juvenile court and try to help kids get through this period and successfully and safely for themselves and society, they got transferred to adult court, you know, at younger and younger ages. So that's part of the period that I'm talking about there. There was no other voice. I mean, there were, you know, occasional dissenting views, but not in terms of the mainstream of politics. And there wasn't even that much difference, you know, around the country. Not everybody went as far as everybody else. But that's what it was like, you know, at that time. And so I think, you know, that's the way I understand that history. And that, as I said, it was not just a drug policy history. In fact, it was much more, as I've said, a crime policy. History.
So are the courts are the courts being used for punishment only? Are they being used for treatment in any way?
During that period of time, the whole treatment ethos disappeared. Right. I mean, it was there. All these things that we now see as being sound policy and were, frankly, if I can put it this way, in the 1970s also. People, when they talk, this is another, this is a little pet peeve of mine. When people talk about the drug war, and now I'm talking about this broader thing that was going on, they identify it with Richard Nixon, because he was the first one that I think probably used the phrase. I don't know this, but, you know, he declared war on drugs. But actually, during the Nixon administration, and I was in Washington, you know, during this period of time, he disavowed our report. But actually, what they did was very consistent with the report. They reduced penalties for marijuana and very importantly instituted a treatment-oriented policy. Methadone maintenance began during the Nixon administration. And the amount of money that was poured into a drug treatment policy was very substantial, right? And when you go back and you look at the history, it was probably, you know, more per capita or how as a percentage of the budget than you would find at any later time, right? So the policies that were actually being adopted with regard to drug policy until what I described to you at the end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s, was actually fairly enlightened public health-oriented policy. And there were people like me, you know, and all the people that were actually in the government during the Nixon and Ford administration and in the Carter administration also actually favored the policies that I'm describing to you now. But as I said, the pendulum swung, and people can, you know, talk about, you know, try to explain it. Historians can have a good time doing it. But as an observer, I think I'm accurately describing to you what actually happened. All right. So we were in a, you know, a huge, again, I mean, I was a dissenter from this, but nobody was paying any attention. All right. So then let me go back to the marijuana story here, because this is, again, where the historical, you know, currents that I'm talking about. You know, they diverge at various points with regard to marijuana. And so this is what happened. In 1996, California adopted the Compassionate Use Act for marijuana. It was the first state to say we are going to legalize medical marijuana. The marijuana advocacy groups, even going back to the time that, you know, we were holding the commission hearings, wanted to, at the same time we were talking, you know, often it was about recreational use and use for whatever purpose anybody, you know, had for wanting to smoke marijuana at the time. There was also another kind of parallel piece of that, which is that marijuana potentially had medical uses that had been suppressed because of the demonization of the drug, and they wanted to open, you know, the research activity with regard to medical use. Well, the government suppressed that, right? They didn't want to spend any money on it. And yet, from the grassroots, there became a constituency for legalizing medical marijuana. And suddenly, California did it, right? This was the first step in kind of reversing what we, you know, what I had spoken with you about before. And then various states began to try to, you know, legalize medical marijuana. And so then you would be counting the states, you know, that were doing that. And then the pendulum generally swung away from, gradually, you know, from these highly punitive policies as people were beginning to see what was going on. And the debate about marijuana opened again, not only with regard to medical marijuana, but also toward decriminalization. And so on. And that's where I thought we were in the first decade, you know, of the 20th century. Finally, we were getting back to where we should have been in the 1970s. When I described, you know, to you is now let's decriminalize. We are paying a huge price, you know, for putting people in jail. By the way, arrests for marijuana use, for drug policy, drug use of all kind, but particularly for marijuana, which was always the most heavily arrest drug. Possession was most heavily about marijuana. The arrests just went skyrocketed everywhere, right? And when you had stop and search, things going on in New York, what they were finding most of the time was marijuana. And so arrests just, increased everywhere. And there finally became a beginning of a movement to say, we just can't keep doing this. This is very bad policy. So in the first decade of the 20th century, you had more medical marijuana statutes being adopted, and you began to hear the discussions about decriminalization. And I thought, well, this is where we wanted to be. Let's decriminalize across the country, and then we can finally have the discussion about legalization that never was had back, in the 1970s. Well, then, this is the final sentence in this, oration here. A surprising thing happened in 2012, that I was expecting. Of course, we would have continued referenda and state legislative activity with regard to medical marijuana. But Oregon and Washington decided to legalize marijuana, to adopt a regulatory approach to marijuana. And that came out of the blue, as far as I was concerned. I was totally unprepared for that. And that then accelerated what I had thought in a gradual policymaking framework. You'd do decriminalization, you'd monitor what was going on, you'd spend some time thinking about what a regulatory scheme would look like so that you wouldn't make the mistakes that we made with regard to alcohol and tobacco. We can talk about that later if you want. And we would have some real discussion about this. Well, those two states just did it anyway, right? And then that sort of set in motion the process of gradual support for legalization of marijuana that you now described in terms of, how far it's gone between 2012 and 2020, in the, 30 whatever it is states that have decriminalized medical use, and the 16 states that have now, that legalized, medical use and set up regulatory schemes for it. And then the 16 states that are in the process of setting up regulatory schemes for marijuana. So I think you can see that during that period of time, that's a remarkable thing, that happened in the 21st century, right, with regard, given the history that I've just described to you. It just, the pendulum swung all the way, to the other end. And, we can talk about kind of where we are now and what I think about it. But that's the story that right now with regard to marijuana.
Let's take our second break and come back, and because you brought us to how we, that's a fascinating picture because the United States doesn't make quick decisions in 50 years in this country to go from one end where we're not quite all that way, but we're leaning that way, and we swing far to the other side.
And the thing,
and then all the way back.
Right. I haven't mentioned Congress, so that's kind of part as another thing that's kind of in the way of the rational evolution of this policy, and we should talk about that too.
Yeah. So let's take our break and come back and talk about the rest of this and the 2020 votes and how we got to where we are, or how what happened in November of 2020, how that happened. Let's take our break. And here we are again, the last 20 minutes of a fascinating conversation with Professor Richard Bonney here, professor of law and medicine, public policy, as you can tell. We talk about the public policy of drugs in the United States over the last 50 years. So, Professor, we need to talk about Congress because it plays a role, certainly, in everything that happens. But we finished that last segment talking about Oregon and Washington and their 2012 vote to completely legalize marijuana. And so here in 2020, Oregon takes the step to decriminalize all drugs, including cocaine and heroin. Do you think that that is too far? And if so, how do you swing the door back?
Well, okay, I'm going to answer your question, but I think I briefly, I want to, I think we should go back and finish the marijuana story before coming back to this. But let me tell you why I think I'm quite surprised by what happened in Oregon. I don't think it's a continuation of the story we've been talking about for the last 20 minutes. I think it's something different. And because with marijuana, I think there's a heavy libertarian streak in the story about marijuana that we're talking about now. And we should understand that. When you talk about decriminalizing all drugs, nobody is actually arguing for having a regulatory system where you can just go in and get cocaine whenever you want it, you know, over a certain age and so on. I mean, the legalization model that we're talking about here, nobody is really supporting that. That's not part of the argument here. What the argument is the eliminating the highly punitive approach to drug policy generally and drug addiction, you know, in particular, that arresting people who are using drugs and having drug problems, even if it's not lawful for them to get it, right? Putting them in jail is not the right answer to this. That you need to find out what the nature of the problem is, and to the extent that it's an addiction problem, you need to provide them the services that they need so they can alleviate the addiction.
Let me ask you a quick question then.
Yeah.
Are when you say decriminalize, is the law written so that if you catch me with a joint in my pocket versus catching me with 10 kilos of coke in my trunk, am I decriminalized from both?
No. No. So that's what I meant at the beginning of the program, that decriminalization has, in this field, has generally been referring to possession offenses and consumption-related offenses, right? If you were to, quote, decriminalize everything and just say none of this is a crime anymore, none of it is prohibited, but not put a regulatory system in its place and just open the doors to what is now illicit trafficking in an illicit market, that would be the most insane policy that you could possibly imagine, right? If you are going to legalize, you need to set up a regulatory apparatus that will, you know, protect the public health, right? We certainly have done it with alcohol, we've done tobacco, and we're doing it with marijuana. So when we're decriminalizing, we're not just saying the criminal code has nothing to say about this. When we use the term decriminalization, and this is the way that it's being done in the current debate, it's that we don't want to put people who use drugs, notwithstanding the fact that we have made them illegal and that they've obtained them illegally, in jail and arrest them. That is a misuse in the view that I'm, you know, describing now to people. It is a misuse of the criminal law, and it probably causes more harm than good. So we should try to find, you know, certainly for young people, you know, who are, you know, beginning to use the drugs, we want to try to do some things to try to arrest that developmental process, you know, to arrest whatever is going on in light of, you know, developmental difficulties or whatever that the young person is having. And then for young adults, you know, as well. But for older people who are using the, you know, drugs, most of the time they have, you know, probably a drug use disorder in many cases, not all. And I'm putting marijuana entirely aside, you know, in this discussion. This is why, by the way, the hallucinogens and psilocybin kind of get into the discussion sometimes, too, because there may be people who are, quote, you know, recreationally or even medically in terms of their health using some of those hallucinogens. And so we're seeing some subdivisions beginning to emerge with regard to motivations, you know, for using drugs and so on. And this is all a very healthy debate, you know, in terms of exactly why do we, that was the commission's essential premise, right, in 1972 and 1973. We shouldn't talk about, quote, the drug problem as if it's one thing. It's a lot of different things with different motivations and so on. So we should be having that discussion. But to go to what Oregon did, the key there is that they have withdrawn a criminal punishment from being the main response to people who are who have obtained and are using, you know, these drugs that are basically illicit drugs.
All right. Well, I want to make sure we get to everything that's on our list. So let's go back to 2012 and carry us to 2020.
Okay. So go back to the marijuana story. Okay. So we've just made a little deviation to kind of that goes beyond the marijuana story. And that, as I said, I think ultimately relates to kind of drug policy as well as criminal justice policy. It's a revulsion against, I think, the excessive punishment that's characterized our criminal justice policy. So that's that whole discussion. We'll come back later if we have the time. So now back to resuming the marijuana story. So now you have all these states that have said they want to adopt a regulatory approach to marijuana. I'm going to ignore for you know the time being the medical use states. I'm now want to talk about the states that have adopted a regulatory approach to all marijuana use, like the alcohol, you know, approach. And what they've done is to set up a private, you know, enterprise system and tried to regulate it in various ways. They all haven't done the same thing, so I don't want to say what I'm about to say now is true of all of them. They've got a lot of nuance. They've got a lot of variations. Everybody's experimenting, which is a good thing. This is kind of what I would like to see happen as long as we're measuring the results, you know, in these various states. But my inclination is that you should start without allowing the distribution, the manufacture and distribution of marijuana to be commercialized. That is to say, there should not be promotion and advertising of the use of the drug. And soon as you give private interests a vested interest in selling, you know, the product, they have every incentive, of course, to encourage the use of the product. And they don't have public health as their main interest. And we may want to get there eventually, you know, and you can watch and you can measure what happens and you can try different state approaches. But you shouldn't start that way. And that is the mistake that Colorado and Washington made. It was a mistake from the start. They should have started with a regulatory regime that with much more state control, and certainly that doesn't set up a private interest that wants to encourage people from using the drug in a way that could, in the aggregate, have an impact, a significant impact on the public health. You need to take it gradually. And as I said, I mean, I think there, you know, people can recognize that there are downsides, you know, as we saw with tobacco and also with alcohol. Now, I don't want to sound like a prohibitionist with regard to alcohol, but we need to titrate, you know, the system when we set up a regulatory system. And we had a choice to be able to do it gradually with regard to marijuana instead of, you know, jumping, you know, all the way to a private enterprise type of system. Now, that's not the only thing states have done. So there's Washington, D.C., and what is the other state? There's a state that actually, right now, I can't remember. This is just my aging process. I can't remember what state it is. It'll occur to me. That has decided that the best way to start this is to legalize cultivation for personal use, right? Allow that, and let's just do that so that people have an opportunity to, you know, get the drug, you know, if they choose to use it, but without putting this whole commercial apparatus in effect. There are other things that can be done that if you don't, you know, that's the least dangerous way to legalize distribution would be to do that, or cultivation and distribution.
Well, Professor, let me jump in because we're winding down, and now you're talking about individual states.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about Portugal, and we've got about 6 or 7 minutes left.
Okay.
Where does Virginia stand in all this?
All right. So Virginia is one of the states. Obviously, hasn't done any of this yet. And it's clear that the General Assembly, I mean, they've kind of crossed the, and the governor with support, you know, they were considering over the last couple of years, decriminalization and legalization as part of the range of alternatives. And they did in multiple reports, both from the General Assembly and then from the governor, you know, have gone through these many, many, many policy options that exist. And that's exactly what they should be doing, right? Is not just assume that we're going to go essentially to a private enterprise model, you know, with this, and that we need to think about what some, and you, at least you would want to take one step at a time. And that is where the discussion is, you know, in Virginia now, and that's where it should be. And they should take their time in deciding what model. They should take, you know, small steps initially in that direction, and then they should monitor what the consequences will be. I think so. That is, I think, the story with regard to Virginia. But there will be, you know, continued discussion about that. Legalization is fine, but you should do it gradually and in a way that, you know, try makes every effort that you can to protect, you know, the public health. I should also say another thing about the marijuana story, too, because it's important, is that when people ask, why did this happen? You know, politically across the country, when it started in 2012, and then, you know, in the West, and then gradually, you know, at least with regard to recreational use and not medical use. But I think the medical use is related to what I'm about to say. I think there is an important libertarian feature of this you know, has to be understood, because it's the libertarian part that then has to be weighed against the public health arguments that I am making. Right. I mean, that's the same argument with regard to tobacco. It's the same argument with, and I don't want to put all these, you know, substances in the same kettle. It's just the nature of the public debate, you know, about it. And certainly with regard to alcohol, is there's a tension between leave me alone and let me choose to do what I want, you know, understanding we got to know drunk driving and so on. But in a way that, you know, tries to keep things under control in terms of the harms that clearly can result, you know, to the mind and body with regard to the use of these drugs. And that's where the debate is, and that's where it belongs, you know, with regard to marijuana policy right now. One of the things that's important here is the federal government needs to get out of the way, right? Right now, everything that is happening with regard to marijuana law, regulatory approaches to marijuana, the legalization part of it, is entirely contrary to federal law. Everything that is happening violates federal law, but fortunately, frankly, the federal government has, you know, basically sent the word out that it's not going to enforce these, you know, federal laws as long as the states behave responsibly. Now, how much they are monitoring what the states are doing and so on is a different story. But that is not where we ought to be. There is a massive default of responsibility that has occurred here on the part of the Congress of the United States. They should have done something about this after California did what it did in 1996, and at least, you know, somewhere along the way. And it has never been able to get its act together, because what they should have done and can do now up to a certain point is to say, we're going to make marijuana in a different schedule altogether, you know, a federal law. It's not going to be, you know, with all the, you know, so-called, you know, illegal drugs. We're going to basically say it doesn't violate federal law if the states, if it's in conformity with state policies that meet certain minimum conditions that the federal government should set. And Congress should say, here are the conditions that have to be met. The Department of Justice and, you know, one of the Health and Human Services departments working together should, you know, issue regulations that then provide some constraints on what the states can do. Now, that's what should have been done a long time ago, and even now it should be done. But the cat, you know, I mean, may be out of the bag now, because so many states have basically gone off on their own. But I think that's an important part of the story.
Is okay, that- so let's make time for this. We got about 2 minutes left.
Yes.
What's going on in Portugal? Because you've mentioned Portugal a couple times.
Right. So now I think this is the back to the other story. It's drugs in general is what they have done. They have said we are going to withdraw, you know, criminalization and criminal penalties and punishment from people who are using drugs, even if they are illegal drugs, cocaine, heroin, whatever it is. And this is the model that led to what Oregon, you know, has now done. But what Portugal did from the start is make it clear that they weren't trying to encourage use of the drugs, and they weren't saying that they weren't going to intervene in the lives of people whose drug use indicates that they have a serious drug problem. And that for young people, for example, they may want to have some prevention programs, some education programs, some counseling programs that the person has to comply, you know, participate in. And if the person is addicted, that they are going to be have to be basically, I want to say committed because it's the word that we would use now, but basically has to, you know, to accept medical assistance for their addiction. So it's not that we're leaving them alone and saying, do whatever you want. It's we're moving the criminal law out of it. And that, I think, is the, you know, is the key element of that. And it, again, returns to policies that have been discussed, you know, off and on over the decades and should be a key element of whatever we do with regard to national drug policy. And we've got the opioid epidemic and avoiding use of the criminal law, trying to promote treatment and involvement in treatment voluntarily if possible is what we should be doing now with regard to that. But I think that's not the marijuana story. I think that's a broader story that goes back to the evils of the drug war and the need to reassign the roles of the criminal justice system.
It's a fascinating conversation that is impossible to condense into an hour.
But we did, right?
You have done a fascinating job, but I feel like we ate the basic meat and we left out so much of the savory pieces. And I hope that you'll come back in the future because there's so much left to talk about.
Yeah. Yeah. It is a very interesting story and you've heard it in 50 years worth of it.
Well, I think there's a lot more, and I think I know I'm interested, and I hope the listeners are too, and that we can convince you to come back and we can take one of those tangents and blow it up into an hour. Professor Richard Bonney, professor of law and medicine and public policy, University of Virginia. Thank you, sir, for being with us today.
Thank you for giving me a chance to tell the story.
And next week, Santa Claus comes to town on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call and will be calling little kids to remind them to be well behaved and find out what they'd like for Christmas. Thanks, everybody.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at cvillepodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.